Trevor Aronson is an associate director and co-founder of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, a nonprofit journalism organization that produces reporting about Florida and Latin America in English and Spanish. He previously was an investigative reporter and editor for the Commercial Appeal in Memphis, a staff writer for Village Voice Media's newspapers in Miami and Fort Lauderdale. His work has won more than 24 national and regional awards, including one from Society of Professional Journalists and another from the Association of Alternative Weeklies. Aronson also happens to be an investigative reporting fellow at the University of California in Berkeley, where he developed a year-long project about the FBI's informants in U.S. Muslim communities, which culminated in an article entitled The Informants, published in this month's Mother Jones, and that is what we will be talking with him about today. Welcome, Trevor Aronson, to Takes on the World.
Thanks for having me.
Since 9/11, the federal government has made a big deal about how it has been successful in preventing another major terrorist attack along the lines of 9/11 by making numerous arrests and getting convictions of domestic terrorists and would-be terrorists across the country, but mainly in America's Muslim communities. Your well-researched article casts that story in a different light. Let's talk about that.
Right. What we decided to do is take a look at the more than 500 prosecutions, terrorism prosecutions since 9/11, and we took a specifically close look at the terrorism plots. You know, I'm sure as everyone has remembered that since 9/11, in communities around the country, there's usually been some kind of press conference where a U.S. attorney says, you know, we've foiled yet another terrorist attack. There was a plot to bomb the Washington Metro system, for example. Last year, around Christmas, there was a plot to bomb a Christmas tree lighting ceremony in Portland. And what we found is that in most of those plots, the defendant had little or no capacity to actually commit any sorts of act of terror. It was, in fact, the result of an FBI sting operation where, through the use of informants, they identified someone who was interested in committing some sort of act of violence or act of terrorism. They then provided either the plot or and or the means for them to carry forward with that terrorist act. And when they get them to the point of, say, you know, dialing a cell phone that they believe will, blow up a van full of explosives, they're then arrested. But in all of these cases, the evidence suggested that were it not for the FBI informant and the undercover agent providing the means for these defendants, they never would have committed or had the capacity to commit these crimes.
Well, yeah, actually, it seems that they've gone in and into mosques and tried to find kind of weak links and kind of baited them and even pushed a number of these people who by themselves, even in a group, being capable of acting into admitting on tape what they're ready to do, even though some of the critical tapes happen to be missing.
That's right. That's right. So there's a couple of things going on. One of the ways that the FBI is able to find these people, find someone who's interested in committing an act of violence, is through the aggressive and widespread use of informants. And what we found today is that the informant network that the FBI has is unprecedented and massive. Today, it's 15,000 informants nationwide. And for historical context on that, in the mid-70s, after the COINTEL programs that everyone kind of associates with FBI's use of informants, there were 1,500 informants. So we're talking a tenfold increase from 35 years ago after the counterintelligence programs. And what these informants do is they go into communities and they look for people who say they want to commit some sort of act of violence, and then they draw them into the sting operations. But a big problem in these sting operations has been that many of the recordings are missing. So, for example, when they get someone who says they want to commit some sort of act of terrorism or act of violence, at times an informant will spend months with the person, kind of cultivating the relationship that allows the sting operation to happen. And in cases, you know, that can go on for months and months, and recordings are never made. And that's a critical time period that defense attorneys would need to show entrapment, to know what was said and whether there are any inducements made. And time after time, you know, in these sting cases, there's months or weeks are spent between an informant and a target, and those recordings are never made.
It seems one of the ways they get people to inform, I mean, there are different motivations, but one of the ways, it has a long history, is coercion or blackmail. And how big a role does that play?
a significant role, and it's important to understand the nuances of how it's changed. You know, I think when people think of how an informant is, how someone becomes an informant, there's a pop culture reference. So I mean, as anyone who's ever seen a mobster movie or watched The Sopranos knows, you know, oftentimes in the FBI, when the FBI was battling organized crime in the 70s and 80s, what it would do would find someone who, for example, was maybe stealing cars and use that as leverage against them to say, okay, well, we got you on this racket stealing cars. If you work with us, we'll make this go away. But so they use criminal prosecution as a means of leverage to get someone to cooperate. But in recruiting informants from within the Muslim community, it's important to realize that the Muslim community in the United States, Muslim communities, I should say, are very affluent, law-abiding communities. So you're not going to find many people stealing cars. So as a result, the FBI has turned to immigration as that form of leverage to recruit within Muslim communities. So they try to find people who have technical violations, and it's not very difficult to get a technical violation for immigration. Or, for example, they're trying to bring their family from overseas, and the FBI will use that as leverage to say, well, you know, you have this immigration violation. If you work with us, we'll make that go away. Or, you know, hey, we know you're trying to get your family over from Lebanon. If you work with us, we'll help make that happen.
Or if they might be facing deportation, they will not be deported.
Exactly, and the FBI has admitted that it works with what it terms helpful informants to make sure that in cases where they're not being where they're facing deportation, the FBI makes sure that doesn't happen.
And now, Eric Holder, the Attorney General, has bragged about this. How much has this program increased under the Obama administration as compared to the Bush administration?
It's increased at a steady clip. I mean, you know, Holder, when he was in before a group of Muslim lawyers and civil rights leaders in San Francisco, said that these sting operations are a critical means for counterterrorism, a critical means of preventing the next attack. And what we found is that it's actually increased. There's been an increase in the number of cases involving sting operations and the use of informants since Obama has taken office. And indeed, there's been a steady increase in, you know, the way in the informants are used, and we have every expectation to believe that that will continue under the Obama administration, just as it did under the Bush administration.
Now, one of the things you talked about, interesting, is the change strategies on the part of the government. Initially, they were looking, you said, for terror cells, sleeper cells that would be snuck into the cross our borders from Al Qaeda or some other group. But now that's changed. And how has that changed?
Right. Well, there is still a threat, for example, of someone coming in from overseas. As you know, there was that potential threat on the 10th anniversary of 9/11 of someone coming through. Ultimately, that didn't happen. But that, in the FBI's view, is less likely than someone who's already in the United States, often a U.S. citizen, who becomes inspired to commit some sort of act of violence through friends or through reading extremist message boards online. And then goes out and tries to find the means to commit that act of terrorism. The FBI refers to this as a lone wolf, someone, you know, out somewhere wanting to do violence in the United States if he only had the means and the ability to do so. And so these informants and these sting operations are meant to identify these so-called lone wolves and then lure them into sting operations as a means of using the only way the FBI has to get someone off the street, which is criminal prosecution. So if you can prove the criminal conspiracy in a sting operation, the FBI can then use that in court to prosecute and effectively get the person off the street. What the FBI says in its defense is that when it identifies someone like this, someone who says they want to commit some sort of act of terrorism, you know, what would you have us do? Would you just say, leave him alone and hope he matures and don't worry about it? Or do you do what the FBI does, which is to create a sting operation and get him off the street? And in the FBI's view, it's more dangerous to allow these people to kind of, you know, to continue on living with us for fear that someone might actually provide them with the materials that the FBI informant or undercover agent is pretending to in these sting operations.
Now, when most Americans hear Muslims, they think of people born in the Middle East or Southeast Asia. But it seems a number of people who've been busted and are involved in this are converts to Islam. And quite often we find whatever religion someone converts to, they become much more zealous in the pursuit of the religion, what they think is a proper pursuit, than those who were, let's say, born into it. How big a role have converts played in this?
In sting operations, converts play a really prevalent role. I would estimate nearly half of sting operations involve someone who converted to Islam. And that's something that in some of the cases we looked at, the informant was able to use against the person. In a number of these cases, the convert had very elementary understanding, had a very elementary understanding of Islam, and the informant was able to tell him that things were in the Quran, for example, that weren't there, as a means of saying, you know, getting him to move along in this plot. And I think that's really interesting to note that in many of these cases, in many of these terrorist plots that you've heard of, this isn't the, you know, someone who fits Muhammad Atta's profile of someone, you know, someone born in Saudi Arabia and lived overseas their whole life and comes to the United States. This is someone who grew up in the United States, only recently converted to Islam, and, you know, for some reason decides they want to get involved in some sort of jihad of some purpose, but really has such, you know, limited understanding of what Islam is and what the Quran says about the things that they're espousing.
My guest is Trevor Aronson. We're talking about his article in the current Mother Jones, The Informants, about U.S. government infiltration of the Muslim community in order to trap Muslims as potential terrorists. There's interesting profiles of certain individuals in your article, which make it really very interesting reading, even like one exchange that you have in there between Shahid Hussein and what the group called the Liberty City Gang was supposed to bomb Sears Towers. It's almost like a Saturday Night Live skit. Perhaps you could talk about that and who this Shahid Hussein was and what he was able to do.
Sure. Actually, in that case, the informant was a man named Eli Assad. And Eli was a man with a checkered background. He had failed a polygraph examination in Chicago when he was working with the FBI that should have precluded him from working with the FBI again, but didn't. We ended up getting busted for beating up his girlfriend at one point his pregnant girlfriend, I should say, in Miami. And what ended up happening was he was brought in as a secondary informant in an operation where the FBI believed seven men living in Liberty City, which is a very economically depressed area of Miami, were interested in becoming a kind of terrorist cell. And so what Eli Assad did was pose as an al-Qaeda operative who was tasked with, you know, putting together the cell and financing the cell and moving forward with this plot. So the way that they were able to prove the case against the Liberty City Seven was Eli provided them with a camera that they used to take pictures of the Miami FBI office to prove the conspiracy that they wanted to bomb that office. But among the most damning pieces of evidence was an oath to al-Qaeda that they ended up taking. And the initial oath between the informant and Narsil Batiste, who is the leader of this group of Liberty City 7, ended up coming off in the transcripts and the recording as an Abbott and Costello routine where, you know, there was very unclear what the oath was, and it was clear that Narsil wasn't even sure what he was taking an oath for. And at one point in the oath, it says that, you know, they'll be working under something to the effect of they'll be working under al-Qaeda, and Narsil objects to that term because he's his own man. He doesn't serve anyone. And it just became this very humorous exchange where it was clear that Narsil was kind of saying whatever the informant wanted him to say, because what other tapes suggested was that Narsil Batiste and the Liberty City Seven were scamming the informant as much as the informant was scamming them. There was every indication that Narsil and his colleagues were trying to get money. You know, every time there would be a talk of some kind of terrorist act, Narsil would always say, "Well, when's the money coming in? When's the money?" And so what the defense ultimately used at trial, and what was borne out in the transcript, was that, you know, if Narsil Batiste and the other members of the Liberty City Seven were interested in any kind of act of terror, they were just as interested in making some money out of the deal. And certainly that raises questions about, you know, I don't think a true terrorist is so much interested in the money as it is the act of terrorism that he or she would be interested in waging.
And yet these men were sentenced to prison for 7 to 13 years.
That's right. It wasn't easy for the government to prove that. It ended up taking three trials before they were able to, they got convictions on five of the seven.
I mentioned earlier the story of Agent Shahed Hussein. Perhaps you could talk about his role.
Sure. Shahed Hussein was initially came to the United States from Pakistan. He was from a wealthy family that actually lived next door to Benazir Bhutto's family, the former prime minister of Pakistan. Shahed was charged with murder in Pakistan and fled to the United States. He alleges the murder was the charges were trumped up and were politically motivated. Whether that's true or not is unclear. But what we do know is that he then came to Albany, New York, and built a business where he had several convenience stores and a gas station. One of those convenience stores was next door to the Albany Department of Motor and Vehicles, and Shahed could speak several languages, including Urdu, and ended up getting a kind of a sideline job translating for the DMV. So, for example, if you spoke Urdu and you needed to take the test, you know, Shahed was there to help you, and he was paid as a consultant or a contractor to do that. But Shahed, kind of being a very entrepreneurial guy, realized that he could make some extra money by helping these people cheat on tests, and so they would pay him an extra kickback, and he'd help them pass the written test. In other cases, if you needed to pass the driving test, Shahed could make that happen by, you know, giving kickbacks to one of the DMV employees. The FBI ultimately realized this and sent an informant in, and they used a sting operation against Shahed Hussein, and they got him on charges for facilitating the manufacturing of these fake IDs, basically to the DMV. And so what Shahed did was what many people do, which is he cooperated with the government to get those charges to go away, and he cooperated as an informant. His first job was to use a sting operation against everyone he worked with at the DMV, but then, you know, Shahed Hussein, being from Pakistan, speaking Urdu, was a very good person for the FBI to use in counterterrorism operations, and they first used him in a case involving an imam in Albany named Yasin Aref. And they put together a sting operation where Yasin Aref and another man were believed to be moving money for terrorists. There was questions at trial as to whether they believed it was a loan or if they did believe it was, in fact, terrorism. Those two ultimately were convicted, and Shahed Hussein was then moved to an area outside New York City, an economically depressed area called Newburgh. He then trolled the mosque there for almost a year before he finally ran into a man named James Cromedy. Cromedy was a Walmart stalker. He converted to Islam in prison when he was serving cocaine charges and had a history of mental problems. He told a psychologist at one point that he would see and hear things that weren't there, that he tried to commit suicide twice. Yet James Cromedy ended up being the focus of an FBI sting in which he and three other people, led by Shahed Hussein, got involved in a conspiracy to bomb synagogues in the Bronx and fire Stinger missiles at airplanes taking off from Stewart International Airport. What was particularly interesting about that case, in fact, was that the whole plot, the idea, the means all came from Shahed Hussein. You know, for example, when Shahed Hussein asked James Cromedy initially, you know, what would you do if you could, you know, commit an act of terror? And James Cromedy's answer was, oh, I'd blow up a bridge. And of course, no one can really blow up a bridge. And I mean, no one of any kind of small terror cell of sorts would be able to blow up a bridge. And so Shahed Hussein gets him to, like, you know, do something more manageable. And he mentions the Mumbai attacks from a few years ago, and gets Cromedy to go forward with this plot. And Shahed Hussein, in turn, provides the bombs that they're to use, all the while, you know, continually inducing James Cromedy. At one point, he offers him $250,000. At another point, he offers him a barbershop. All of this came up at trial, and ultimately, James Cromedy and the three others were convicted for the terrorism conspiracy. But also what came out of the trial was that Shahed Hussein, the informant, continually lied. At one point, while he was an FBI informant, he was in bankruptcy court and did not disclose to the bankruptcy court that he had $500,000 in a trust fund in Pakistan. And so he was delaying creditors throughout New York, saying that he was bankrupt, all the while he had a bunch of money in an account overseas. And so he's a really great example of the type of person the FBI uses in these sting operations, where credibility is a real question, because not only was Shahed Hussein a criminal, but, you know, there was documentation that he was lying, including while being an FBI informant.
Well, there's a long history, of course, of this, and not probably only in the United States, but in other countries around the world. We saw this during the Red Scare in the post-war in the United States, they were looking for communists under every bed. We saw this in the COINTELPRO operations, which were directed largely against the black community, particularly the Black Panthers, when they would get people to turn and become informers. But of course, with the technological improvements today, for example, it's a lot easier to record someone conversation than it was, let's say, 20, 30 years ago. That's why there's some real question about when the FBI agent says, informant says, well, we don't have those tapes because of a technical glitch or it was difficult to get a recording. You're right that that's really questionable, and you quote former FBI people questioning the fact that these recordings were not available, ones in which they actually were entrapping their target.
That's right. You know, I think when people think of a wire, like as it's been kind of popularized in on TV shows, it's like it's a big box that you wear on your belt, and a wire goes up and it straps to your chest, and you know, it's something that could be easily found. Well, that's how wires used to be. That isn't how they are today. That is not what the FBI really uses any longer. The devices that they now have access to are far more sophisticated. You know, they're small little transponder devices that look like a key fob, and you're able to put that on a table, and the recording is then transmitted to an off-site location where it makes that recording. And so what an agent like James Weddick mentioned to me was that he finds it very disconcerting that there have been so many instances in these terrorism stings where the FBI says, well, we don't have a recording of that, for either that, you know, they didn't think a recording was necessary, or there was a recording malfunction of some kind, according to some of these criminal affidavits. And what Weddick says is that, you know, the technology today is so sophisticated that A, there really isn't a reason not to record conversations between an informant and a target, and B, because the technology is so sophisticated, there's a very low incidence of malfunction. I mean, obviously, any technology malfunctions at some point, but because of the sophistication of the current technology, that there really should be a really low error rate. And what we found in our investigation was that, in fact, most cases involved conversations, including very, very important conversations, that were not recorded either at will or because of some kind of recorder malfunction, according to the FBI.
My guest is Trevor Aronson. I'm going to actually open the phones here in a couple of minutes for your calls and comments. One thing you mentioned is that most of those who have been arrested admit their guilt. And explain why.
Right. So what we found is that 80% of the 500 cases that we looked at resulted in guilty pleas. And that's for a couple reasons. One, across the federal system, a high rate of guilty pleas is common, in part because it's very difficult to beat the federal government on the federal level. The other part is that it's even more difficult to beat terrorism charges. What legal scholars that look at some of these cases theorize is that because the plots are so fantastic, because, you know, it involves such scary ideas like the bombing of a subway system or the bombing of a, you know, building of some sort, that it really overwhelms the jury to such an extent that entrapment isn't really a feasible defense. And for that reason, the conviction rate is so high. Mandatory sentencing makes, you know, the person who's going to trial look at, you know, decades in prison. And so in many cases, defendants, actually in 8 out of 10 cases, defendants make the decision that to plead out rather than fight the cases at trial, which makes things like our research even harder, because every time someone pleads out before going to trial, much of the information about the case never becomes public. So in some of these cases, we don't know the full extent of the informant's actions because the person pleaded it out, and the FBI never had to disclose that through the courts.
Since a number of these targets for the sting, FBI stings, are poor, how easy is it for them to get a legal counsel?
For the most part, it's the federal public defender who's defending them. Yeah, I mean, in many cases, you know, they do get very effective counsel, even though they're dealing with the public defender system. But you're right. I mean, it's not the high priced lawyers who are coming to their defense. It's whoever's available, you know, to fight for them in those cases. You know, and depending, and that can vary. The quality of the attorney obviously varies by, to a certain extent, the region, as well as the luck of the draw and which attorneys they're able to get.
And I could imagine that American Muslim organizations wouldn't want to become involved in these cases because they've already connected enough in the public minds to Islamic terrorism. And so by trying to defend one of these defendants that would even make them closer in the public's mind.
That's right. And, you know, and to a certain extent, too, I think it's important to note that, you know, some of these Muslim organizations do point out that some of these defendants, especially recent converts, you know, that really have such crude and elementary understandings of Islam. I mean, there's really questions, are they really Muslim, or is the government just kind of saying that they're Muslim? Or, you know, just because the guy says he's Muslim, he doesn't have any understanding of the religion. You know, is he kind of one of us is one of the questions for Muslim groups. But also, you know, I think the Muslim groups that like Muslim Advocates and the Council for American Islamic Relations are more interested in fighting kind of broader issues like constitutional rights. You know, for example, CARE and the ACLU have a lawsuit pending down in Southern California about the use of informants. So I think instead of focusing on specific defendants, I think these organizations are focusing more on the broader constitutional issues instead.
My guest again is Trevor Aronson. The number here is 895-2448 or 1-800, let's see this here, 895-2448. You have one character in there who sounds like a TV series could be made around him, Craig Montell, a muscle-bound 49-year-old who seems to take a lot of different roles and has been served as a major informant for the FBI. Tell us about him.
Right. So Craig Montell began his kind of criminal career in Southern California, in the San Diego area, ripping off drug dealers, basically. You know, he would say he had a bunch of drugs to sell, and the person would bring money, or he had a bunch of money and the drugs to buy, and somehow he'd end up ripping them off and get away with it and run off with their drugs or their money. And at one point, one of the drug organizations was after him, and Craig went to the Drug Enforcement Administration and told him what he was doing and the contacts he had. The Drug Enforcement Administration realized that there was greater value in Craig as an informant than as someone they would prosecute for his activities. And so he ended up becoming a criminal informant for the Drug Enforcement Administration. And then over time was transferred to the FBI, and he worked drug cases, he worked murder-for-hire cases. Craig is half Cajun, half African-American, and he has a kind of look that he could be just about any ethnicity. And as a result, he's a very kind of effective, what the FBI term, chameleon, where, you know, just about anywhere you want to send him, he can go. And, you know, at one point he investigated white supremacists and posed as an Aryan, you know, part of a member of the Aryan Nation. And most recently, he was used in Orange County posing as a French-Syrian man and recent convert to Islam. And his job was to go through mosques throughout Southern California and provide information. He says his main job was to provide information that the FBI could use as leverage to recruit informants. So, for example, he was looking for people that had immigration violations, vices perhaps, such as pornography, other things like extramarital affairs, that the FBI could then use as leverage to say, well, hey, you know, we'll make this this immigration violation go away if you work with us, or, you know, we won't tell your wife about the woman on the side if you work with us. All forms of leverage to try to get them to cooperate as informants. And what ended up happening was, through a rather sordid and complicated affair, Craig's relationship with the FBI fell out, and about 2 or 3 years ago, he came forward and said, I'm an informant, and this is what I did, and basically documented what the ACLU and CARE allege are widespread constitutional violations, that the FBI was sending an informant in without any belief that a predicate existed. And by predicate, I mean without any belief that people in these communities, in the mosques and the community centers that Craig Monte had gone into as an informant, there was no belief that, on the FBI's part, that these people were up to any kind of criminal activity, which is required to launch investigations involving an informant like Craig Monte.
Thanks for that. We have a caller on the air here. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeff. Yeah, I wanted to make 2 points. First, as far as tapes by law enforcement, LE, I have been a defendant, and I've helped research for defendants on cases where we found that when allegedly a tape malfunctioned or the batteries were dead or, gee, I forgot to turn the machine on, actually involved information that would have exonerated the person, and it got lost accidentally on purpose. And the other point is Tim McVeigh, as soon as that happened in the Murrah building in Oklahoma, they thought it was they said, oh, gee, it must be a Muslim terrorist. As soon as they found out it was a Christian white guy, the terrorist term dropped. Same thing with Joe Stack, who flew an airplane into a building, an IRS office in Texas last year. Never the word terrorist, yet a guy flies a plane into a building. They both happen to be white guys. And I'd like a response from your guest on that. Thanks for the show. Great show.
Thanks.
I'll respond to the second part first. The second part involving the guy with the airplane, as I recall from that one, that was he was what's termed a sovereign citizen, which is a growing movement in the United States of people who believe that the government doesn't have a true authority and that you can opt out of what they consider contracts with the government. So a lot of, it has its roots in tax evasion and in tax evaders. But what's happening is that this particular movement, and it does tend to be primarily white men who are involved, has become increasingly violent. So the guy who flew the airplane into that building was a sovereign citizen. As I remember, a little over a year ago, there was a shooting of two police officers in West Memphis, Arkansas, involving a white man who was a sovereign citizen. And so I think there is a growing threat, and the FBI does realize this, of whether it's terrorism or whether it's something else, of these kind of very fringe groups of people and white people specifically who are interested in doing harm and violence. You know, and in the case of sovereign citizens, in many cases, they're doing it out of this crazy paranoia that they believe the government is out to get them. As far as the use of the missing recordings, one of the good examples of that, I mean, whether there's information that exonerates someone is impossible to know unless you're able to uncover a tape that the government said didn't exist. But what we do know in one of these cases is that there was a sting operation in Baltimore involving a young convert named Antonio Martinez, and he began to realize that he was involved in a sting operation and called the informant and basically said, you know, I don't want any BS. I think I'm in a sting. I want to get out of this. And the informant then said, you know, sets up a meeting face to face to try to talk about it and bring the guy back into the plot. And so this would be a critical meeting. You know, what does the informant say to bring this guy back in? And that ultimately wasn't recorded due to what the FBI termed a recording malfunction. So I think that's a good example of the type of really critical, important meetings that occur that aren't recorded and are left up to the government to say what happened, because certainly in this case, this man wanted out of the plot and was pulled back in, so the informant must have said something to bring him back, but we'll never know what was said because that recording doesn't exist.
Well, it's interesting that the history of this is a technique seems to be used in a variety of cases. One thing is interesting that you mentioned in the article I didn't quite get into, was with the change role of the FBI used to be one of solving crimes, and now, as you write, it's to create the crimes and then solve them and look good, and that it's like preemptive crime creation. In fact, the narcotics industry, the DEA, kind of works along the same way. But perhaps you could talk about the change of emphasis in the FBI.
Yeah, you know, as one attorney who defended a terrorism case in New York told me that it was his quote that the FBI was creating crimes to solve crimes so it could claim victory on this war on terror. And but what the FBI is doing is an evolution to a certain extent of as you mentioned what they've done in drug cases, which is to set up a sting operation and move forward and bring the person in, you know, the so-called no dope bus. So the idea that, you know, the FBI agent or informant has an empty briefcase that he leads people to believe is full of money or cocaine. The person comes in with the money to purchase what they believe is cocaine, and they get it all on tape. But it turns out the briefcase is empty, and they rush in, and then they bust the people. And they're using the same technique, except instead of no dope or the lack of drugs, it's actually a lack of bombs or a lack of actual terrorism. So, but what the FBI since 9/11, you know, the FBI. Before 9/11, the FBI was traditionally an investigative organization. You know, something would happen, a crime would happen, and the FBI shows up and does what it does to figure out who did it. Today, the emphasis now, the number one emphasis for the FBI is on preventing the next attack. So they're gathering intelligence and working more like an MI5 intelligence organization than as a criminal investigative organization. That is to say, they do both. You know, their primary emphasis is preventing the next attack, so they're working as an intelligence organization, but they're also working as a criminal investigation as well. One of the questions that's been raised since 9/11 and the big push toward counterterrorism is whether the things we've seen in our economy and in our country since 9/11 might have been different were the FBI's priorities different. So, for example, the widespread mortgage fraud that we saw in the middle of this decade, I'm sorry, in the middle of last decade, perhaps would have been somewhat different had the FBI had resources allocated to mortgage fraud, or things like Bernie Madoff and the financial crimes we saw on Wall Street. You know, these are things that before the FBI had greater resources to devote to, but now with counterterrorism being its largest priority, a lot of those resources are instead diverted to preventing the next attack instead of investigating crimes that may otherwise be going on.
So essentially, we don't have an organization equivalent to what the FBI used to be. By the way, I also should mention that and ask you about briefly, become to the end of the program, there's been revelations the New York Police Department has been doing extreme surveillance infiltration of the Muslim community in mosques in New York. I assume there's collaboration between the FBI and the NYPD.
There is some. There's more.
Or competition.
Exactly. There's as much competition as there is collaboration. The FBI, to a certain extent, views NYPD as the local yokels. NYPD views FBI as unable to protect its city. And so, to a certain extent, they're both operating in some cases, competing organizations. There was one example, the Najib Al-Azazi case. The FBI had shared information that it had with NYPD. NYPD accidentally leaked that information to someone Najib Al-Azazi knew, and that information got back to the target. And so there has been some bad blood between the organizations as a result. But they're both doing very similar things. I mean, what the AP reported is the type of activities we're seeing from the FBI as well. That is to say that they're targeting specific ethnic communities that they view as the greater threat, and then assigning informants accordingly. Whereas the AP reported that the NYPD is using things like taxi shields as leverage to say, like, you know, we'll make sure you lose your taxi license unless you work with us as an informant. You know, that's very similar to what the FBI does with immigration, to say, you know, unless you work with us as an informant, we're going to make sure your immigration problems, you have immigration problems, or you might get deported. So what we're seeing is very similar things. I mean, there's some collaboration, but also as much competition. But the tactics are very similar between the two agencies.
Well, thank you very much, Trevor Aronson, for being our guest today in Takes on the World. His article, The Informants, can be found in the September-October edition of Mother Jones. It's very worth reading, both for the style and the information. And so thanks very much for being our guest again today.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Take care.